Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. You've heard the old joke, everybody complains about the weather, but nobody does anything about it. Well, everybody in Los Angeles knows the earthquake is coming, the big one. But LA's trying to do something about it. Now, this year, seismologist Lucy Jones has been tapped by the mayor to get the city to get seriously ready, to plan, prepare, now. And it's not just about hiding under your desk. This hour on Point, LA's earthquake lady, getting down to business on the big one. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Can you picture the big one in LA when it comes and the impact? Power, water, phone lines, internet, roads, public transit, sewage, cell phones with 18 million people there. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. California knows its earthquakes, has for a long time. October 89, the Loma Prieta earthquake struck San Francisco Bay Area, California. Here was Dan Rather reporting then for CBS News the morning after.
On the ground below, scenes of a natural disaster.
Back far enough where you can see it fall down. And you knew all the cars in front of it are gone.
The deadliest earthquake in the United States in more than 80 years kills close to 300 people as it snaps roadways into pieces, reduces buildings to rubble, and touches off fires.
And Los Angeles, no immunity, far from it. January 1994, the Northridge earthquake struck the San Fernando Valley, northeastern part of greater metropolitan LA. Here was Tom Brokaw reporting for NBC Nightly News.
This area is still trying to recover tonight from a major earthquake that struck early this morning in the San Fernando Valley in Northridge, which is about 10 miles northwest of where I'm standing, and it did major damage throughout the Los Angeles basin. It was 6.6 on the Richter scale. Five major highways have been cut, water supplies threatened, gas mains have exploded, a half dozen communities have exploded in flames, and the death toll has been going up all day long.
Joining me now from Pasadena, California, is seismologist Lucille Jones. In L.A., they call her the earthquake lady. At the U.S. Geological Survey, she advises on risk reduction from quakes. In January, L.A. Mayor Garcetti appointed her to serve a one-year term as his science advisor for seismic safety to get the city to amp up its preparations for a big quake, the big quake. Lucille Jones, Lucy, it's great to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tom.
Help us understand. You're the seismologist. I mean, we read here that one of these big ones comes about every 150 years in the LA area, that it's now been 300 years. What does that mean to a seismologist?
Well, it means that it's really a very random process. It doesn't tell me that the earthquake has to happen soon. I will say I joined the USGS 30 years ago, mm-hmm. and I did think that I would see a San Andreas earthquake in my career, and it's starting to look less likely that that's actually going to happen. But whatever happens on a human short human timescale, the earthquake is absolutely inevitable, and the city absolutely has to be ready for it, because if it happened today, our studies of the earthquake say the disruption could be so substantial that we would lose our economy. Not that many people would die, relatively speaking, but we might have it that you just really couldn't go to work. If you haven't had a shower for a month, are you staying in LA? Probably not. And people who leave tend to not come back.
Talk about parade of horribles, a phrase in the news this week, but you've got quite a parade there. Help us understand. When people talk about the big one or a big one, we hear about earthquakes in California frequently, not infrequently in and around L.A., but when they talk about the big one, what does that mean?
Usually it means that we're going to have the earthquake on the San Andreas Fault. So here in Southern California, we have several hundred faults. We have a greater density of different faults than anywhere else in the country. And put that with all the people we have one quarter of the nation's seismic risk just in Los Angeles County alone. And any one of them could produce a pretty big earthquake. And actually, if we had a 7 or a 7.5, or when it happens, on a fault in Los Angeles, that's going to be potentially the most devastating earthquake. But that doesn't happen that often. The San Andreas is such a fast-moving fault that, as you've been saying, it has earthquakes really quite often. And what's different about a 7.8, which is one of, you know, a likely size, it's what 1906 was, and there was an 1857 earthquake here in Southern California. Mm-hmm. On that type of earthquake, the fault needs to be 200 to 300 miles long to be able to create that big an earthquake. The length of the fault pretty much determines the magnitude. Mm-hmm. And that means instead of like Northridge, which was a 10-mile long fault, and therefore we had about 500,000 people right on top of the earthquake. It was 10 miles right in the middle of the city. On the San Andreas earthquake, with 200, 300 miles long, we'll now have something like 10 million people getting the really strong shaking that 500,000 people got in Northridge. And it's that scale of disaster that really changes what the event is like. Because now when you lose water mains, instead of having, you know, 100, 200 water main breaks, maybe we'll have 1,000, 10,000 water main breaks. And our estimates with the, you know, water companies, as we really looked at what it would be like, we ended up concluding it would take 6 months to repair all the pipes and get water back into everybody's house. And that has huge financial consequences. Our estimate was $50 billion in business disruption cost, with a lot of small businesses especially just going out of business.
I mean, we read how earthquakes can not just shake up a city and bring – they can change history. San Francisco was seen as the New York of the West Coast before its big quake in, what, 1906 or 7. On the other side of that, it's a wonderful city, but it never quite became the New York of the West Coast. It was L.A.
Right. In 1905, you had to go to San Francisco was everything for the West Coast. That decade after the 1906 earthquake is the largest growth decade in the history of Los Angeles. People gave up on San Francisco and moved south, reestablished their businesses down here. And now Los Angeles has got 7 times the population of San Francisco. And, we don't claim to be the New York of the of the West Coast, but
LA is the big one.
LA is a lot bigger than San Francisco now. And San Francisco, it was the 1940s before they got back to the economic level that they'd had in 1905.
It's hard to imagine what that would mean in LA. A couple of years back, this big shakeout earthquake scenario was published that was presuming a 7.8 magnitude tremor, 55 seconds. That's 7 times as long as the 94 Northridge quake. And the conclusion there would be landslides, liquefaction, massive damage to roads, rail lines, water conveyance tunnels, aqueducts, electrical, natural gas lines, telecommunications, on and on and on. It's just unbelievable. And not just, you say water mains and water breaks, but we're talking about going back to the very source of water for all these millions of people, the huge tunnels that bring water, and those tunnels crossing the fault.
That's right. That was one of the reasons we chose to do that shakeout study, that particular earthquake, was as seismologists, we know that when an earthquake happens, the fault moves and everything crossing the fault gets moved with it. And therefore, every aqueduct coming into Southern California will be broken. And, their plans were for what happens when this aqueduct breaks. Well, what we really need to be planning for is when every one of the aqueducts breaks, because that's what the fault is. And then in addition to the aqueducts, you know, all of the lifelines that maintain modern society come through the mountains around LA in relatively few what we call lifeline corridors. And every one of those is crossing the fault. And so when Interstate 15 crosses the fault, it's not just Interstate 15, it's also the railway line. It's also a big electrical transmission line. It's also one of the 3 fiber optic cables that carries all internet communication from LA to the rest of the world. It's also one natural gas pipeline and 2 petroleum product gas lines that actually cross each other at the San Andreas. So in that big study, our pipeline expert looked at this and said, crater. You know, that these are going to explode. We're going to have a crater. We're going to set off a big fire. We're also going to be having fires in the city. So the firemen are going to be fighting the fires in L.A., and that wildland fire is going to be allowed to just burn. And nobody can start repairing the roads and the telecommunications and the electrical lines until the fire is put out.
The point is how to try to minimize that damage, but it's kind of mind-boggling to do it. The same report said 2,000 people would die, 50,000 injured, maybe half a dozen high-rise buildings would collapse, 8,000 buildings, houses of unreinforced concrete collapse, households without water and power for months. That is a city shutdown scenario, or it sounds like it to me, Lucy.
Well, it could be, right? And therefore, you know, we study this and we try to, you know, we created a shakeout drill to try and help people understand what it was that we were saying. It was, I knew it was going to be bad. I myself didn't realize how bad it was going to be till we really put it all together. And so we started really trying to communicate with people, because the other thing I know as a seismologist is that most of that damage is preventable. I love the phrase, you know, the earthquake is inevitable, but the disaster is not. Mm-hmm. And most of those things we talk about, we could retrofit, strengthen various parts of the infrastructure and of our buildings to make a lot of that not happen. But we have to choose to do so. And one of the issues is that we look at Northridge, and we came out of that pretty well. Mm-hmm. And we go, okay. And we've got to understand that Northridge wasn't a big earthquake. The big ones don't happen that often, but when they do, they really are different. The scale leads to a different quality of disruption. And so what I've been doing is trying to focus on not the individual, but on the collective, on what this does to our society, and recognize that when too many of these pieces come apart, we are imperiling our society.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about earthquakes, Los Angeles, and the big one with the seismologist who's thinking through how the city may survive. Seismologist, in many ways, a survivalist in the best sense of the word. Lucille Jones is with us. Lucy Jones has been named science advisor for risk reduction for the U.S. Geological Society. And this year in L.A., she is advising on seismic safety for the mayor of Los Angeles, trying to get the word out that this will come and Los Angeles needs to be ready. We could see a major American city and its economy taken out of commission. Later in this hour, we're going to look at the big battles in San Francisco over development and affordable housing. But quakes first. After the 94 quake hit suburban L.A., got off fairly easily. This past January was the 20th anniversary of that quake. And here, four Angelenos recalled that day on L.A. TV's station KTLA.
Actually lifted up our house and it moved left to right.
Well, I was worried it was going to be the big one.
My mom woke up to a bunch of moving around. She got me freaked out. Got out of the apartment.
The wall next to my bedroom, next to my bed, was leaning in towards my bed.
And that was nowhere near the big one. Earthquake drills every year since 2008. Millions of Californians take part in the so-called shakeout. Shakeout.org has a practice emergency broadcast on its website for Southern Californians to listen to and learn from.
This is an earthquake drill. Right now, drop cover and hold on. Drop to the floor now. During a large earthquake, the ground might jerk strongly and knock you down. Take cover under something sturdy to protect yourself from objects that can be thrown across a room. Hold on to your shelter until the shaking stops.
And they keep coming, of course. Last St. Patrick's Day, Los Angeles had a 5.1 quake, just as Lucy Jones, my guest today, was holding a press conference to explain the quake's shock patterns. An aftershock hit, and the alarm started blaring. Listen.
If you felt a long, slow roll, you're relatively far away from the event. We're having an aftershock now, about 2.7.
Look at that, an aftershock, even as they talked about the quake. Lucy Jones joins us from Pasadena. She's in the thick of this. Tracy is with us from Andover, Massachusetts. Tracy, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Lucy.
Hi.
I actually lived in California during the Northridge earthquake. I lived in Calabasas, which is about next town over, about 5 miles from the epicenter. I'm from New England, but I've moved to California and back twice. And, you know, Lucy mentioned something about earthquakes, you know, people leaving the state in the aftermath, but it's actually what's keeping me from moving back. I mean, honestly, I loved living there, but there's just, you know, I know it's coming and I don't want to be there. It was bad enough the first time, you know. I think people underestimate the fact that, you know, it's terrifying to go through it, but then there's the aftermath where, you know, you have to move out of your house because you have to have all the stucco replaced and all your things break and you can't get anywhere. And I was in grad school. I had to drop out because the aftershocks went on for months and I couldn't sleep. You can't sleep through the night because they wake you up. So
the after really, in many ways, Tracy, is what Lucy Jones is all about. And I want to look at that. Let me get one more call first and we'll go to it. Thank you, Tracy. Lisa in Williston, Vermont. Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I was in San Francisco in 1989 for the Loma Prieta earthquake.
How was it?
It was a fairly big earthquake. It was really intense, mainly because visually I was in a store. There were lots of scooters in the store, California scooter. And the seismic waves you could see in the cement floor and the walls and the ceiling. So it didn't make sense visually. And all I could think of is, I would rather have the tree across the street fall on me than this house.
Yeah, a lot of people run out, though it's not always the right thing to do. Lisa, you were there for that one. I appreciate your call as well. Lucy Jones, your thinking is all about how to prepare, how to make it less damaging. But to think about the importance of that, if we could, I'd like to just walk through the sort of list of vulnerable infrastructures today. If the big one hit today, if it hit as we speak, Let's, if we could, just walk through. Let's start with roads. What would the implications be?
Okay, the roads are some of our better places, actually, because we always prepare for the earthquake that just happened. Mm-hmm. And the damage to freeways in 89 and 94 led to a massive retrofitting program. The state has spent over $9 billion since those earthquakes retrofitting our freeways. So they are in better shape. Unfortunately, our local roads, a lot of local bridges, are likely to become down. We're also worried about debris in the roads that keep people from moving through. The next one is water. We talked about that earlier. It's potentially our biggest vulnerability. And so this project that I'm doing in L.A., I'm working with the Department of Water and Power, and we're coming up with a comprehensive, very long-term seismic resilience plan. We're talking about investing a lot of money in strengthening, putting in more resistant pipes, and strengthening the fault crossings, making sure our dams are safe.
If you don't do that, if it were to happen today with the water tunnels that come across the fault, if those were broken, those sound like huge construction projects to repair. I can't even put the
12
pieces.
To 18 months.
So what happens to a city with, what is it, 18 million in greater L.A.? I just can't even picture it. A massive exodus somewhere? What?
The worst case is that people will just have to give up and leave and they'll be moving off, you know, like what happened to New Orleans. And that's actually one of the things I talk with the L.A. business leaders about. I show them the gross domestic product of New Orleans with time since the hurricane. And they are they're about $15 billion a year below the economic level they were before the hurricane. And they just continue to, you know, that's a long-term loss, like what happened in 1906. And that's the most compelling case I can give to the business leaders.
Who could stay
this
in
is
L.A.?
If
those were broken, you've got 18 million people there. Would 18 million people have to leave for 12 to 18 months? If there's water,
we have some
water. How much?
We have some water. Overall, over the region, about of the third of the water we use, 20 to 30% of the water is local. We have groundwater.
So what population do you think you could support?
Well, if people – obviously, we'd cut out our landscaping. You know,
cut out everything, but those tunnels are gone. Can you support – 5 million for 18 months? Can you support 10?
That's not a number we've tried to work out. Because rather, what I'd much rather do is figure out how to make sure that we've got water. And so another approach that we're taking, we have groundwater in L.A. that we can't use because aerospace industries in the World War II and post-war era contaminated the groundwater with jet fuel. So we have these big aquifers with local water that right now we can't use. So one of our other proposals is let's clean up that groundwater and reduce our dependence because that's a climate change necessity. in the long run, the Sierra snowpack is going away. We have to reduce our dependence on imported water.
But it's not done yet. Electrical and natural gas, the power profile, if it happened today, Lizzie.
Okay, the power is one of the scarier things because even more than water, it's very difficult to function without electricity. And one of the models, because the other thing is a lot of our electricity comes in across the fault. There's really big transmission lines that connect the Colorado River, all of the hydroelectric plants on the Colorado River with the load here in Southern California. That crosses the San Andreas Fault. One of the studies suggested that when that goes down, all of Western North America will be dark within 50 seconds after the break.
For how long?
12 hours outside of the LA area. Inside, we might be able to get something back in 3 days. It might be more like 3 weeks. That's about how long people were without power in the Sendai area of Japan with the magnitude 9 in 2011. We'll probably have extended periods where we'll be dealing with rolling light-ups rather than rolling blackouts. You might have, 2 hours a day that you get to have electricity in your house, and it would be rotated around because we'll have limited amount of electricity. And that's, of course, there will be areas where the other parts of the infrastructure down will take longer to
get
back.
We saw New York with a major outage a few years back, and it was chaos there very quickly. What about the social profile if LA goes to blackout or rolling blackout?
Well, that's another, you get pretty different answers in the modeling. There's a lot of the social sciences show that in the immediate aftermath of a big earthquake, you get an extraordinary level of altruism. You don't see a lot of looting, a lot of that breaking out, the first responder is usually your neighbor, and extraordinary bonds that form that way. The problem gets, if we can't get things up and running within a week or two, that's where you start getting people, where you get a lot more social unrest as things become really bad. So that's actually sort of one of the goals of this project. Let's get ourselves where we can get back up with enough functioning within a week or two that we don't really get that social breakdown.
Nobody wants to go to that with all those millions. Natural gas. I mean, you mentioned fire departments. One can only imagine all those broken lines and, any place there's an open flame, watch out.
Well, yeah, and fire following earthquake is actually the biggest problem. When we did our modeling, we ended up saying that that would double the losses.
Japan knows that very well from history.
Yes. The fires were so extensive. It was such a shocking number that we convened a special panel of fire chiefs, of the fire chiefs from around California who had been active, who ran departments during big earthquakes. And they looked through what we did and said, if anything, an underestimate. So,
how many fires were you estimating for LA?
1,600 for the Southern California, not just LA. And we don't have that many fire departments. And of course, in Northridge, we dealt with this with what's called mutual aid. We have agreements between all of the emergency responders, and LA got the earthquake. San Bernardino sent their firemen to fight alongside the ones in Los Angeles. Well, in a big earthquake like this, where it's such a long fault, San Bernardino is going to be in worse shape than L.A. We're not going to be able to send them.
You can't call at 1,600. Is that 1,600 fires, or does it start to become, several just gigantic fires, never mind the individual?
That was part of the modeling. We went into conflagration, super conflagration, as they called. Our estimate was about $50 billion in damage from the fires.
Where does the water come from to put that out?
There's another one. So again, the plan I'm working on with LA includes a big section on how to support the firefighters. And what we're doing is looking at getting backup firefighting systems and make sure they're connected. So we're looking at things like reservoirs that are no longer can't be used for potable water, abandoned wells. And actually, we're developing quite a reclaimed water system for landscaping uses to try and reduce our water use. Well, we're setting up – they're called purple pipes. So we're setting up purple hydrants. And we're asking that all of the purple pipes go in with seismic-resistant piping, because you can make pipes that don't break. There's a couple of new approaches that have been developed in Japan and some other places, used in New Zealand, and demonstrated to work really, really well.
What percentage of LA's pipes are of that sort now, right now?
There are two pilot projects, and that's it.
Is that less than 1%? Not even countable. And finally, telecommunications. What would happen there? It sounds like chaos, and people want to know what's going on, where loved ones are, emergency services. What about telecoms?
Well, that's actually the interesting thing. We've now got a society where everyone assumes they're connected at all times. But those systems that we are all so dependent on didn't exist the last time we had a big earthquake. 94, the Northridge earthquake occurred a few months before the release of the World Wide Web.
Universal cell phone adoption.
Exactly. So we look at what happened in Japan. They actually did very well, but then when they lost power, they lost power, and when the backup power ran out, then they lost all their cell phones. And so it gets back to power being a big issue. Also, Japan, they have stronger standards for cell phone towers.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things we're looking at the city is how do we make sure that our cell phone towers aren't just, don't kill somebody in an earthquake, but are actually really functioning after the
earthquake. In a big one, what percentage come down by your calculation?
That part we don't know how to make that assessment, because we don't have any data. We don't have earthquakes since we really had cell phone towers. Our biggest concern in LA is that the majority of our towers actually are on buildings. Many of them are old buildings that we expect to be heavily damaged. So we are concerned that we will lose a very large percentage, is the way things are
now. This report said 5 high-rise buildings would collapse. Are we talking really high-rise, like 50, 80 stories?
We don't have 80 in L.A., but yes, we're talking about the steel frame high rises. In the 94 earthquake, we recognized that the steel construction that we had thought was such a great solution for the earthquake problem had a hidden defect, that the welds in the building cracked. They became brittle because of the welding process. They cracked, then cracks propagated into the rest of the building, and we saw a lot of damage. Japan has seen collapse of steel frame buildings. The newer ones were going in. They've changed the approach to doing the welding. Those older ones were pretty concerned, and we went through extensive modeling, and the structural engineers evaluated what we did and said, given these ground motions, the collapse of pre-94 steel moment frame buildings is a credible scenario.
Wow, watch out. Callers, John in Stowe, Vermont. John, you're on.
Hi, how are you?
Well, okay, a little freaked at this picture, but let's hope it doesn't happen this way and Lucy Jones can get L.A. tightened up before then. What have you seen, John?
Well, I was a teenager in Caracas, Venezuela in 1967. And that was a pretty major earthquake. I think it was a 6.5, but, I don't know the exact numbers, but I think there were about 1 million people in the city. And hundreds of them died, and there were about 80,000 to 100,000 homeless after that. And it went on for a long, long, long time. It was a really bad scene for a year.
Yeah, which is a long time, and we're talking maybe 18 million here. John, thanks for your call. Lucy Jones, how many homeless in your scenario after a big one?
About 250,000. One out of every 60 Southern Californians would lose their structures, and that's really significant.
It's kind of overwhelming. Do Angelenos respond to you by closing their ears or by saying, what can we do?
That's been the really cool part that's happening. I didn't expect to get the support that I'm getting. And we're recognizing that it's going to cost money. But I think the message that these are all changeable numbers has gotten through to people. And we seem to be getting a commitment to do it, because it's a commitment to the future of Southern California. And those of us who, I'm a fourth generation Southern Californian.
Yes.
I went to school at MIT. I know what Boston's like, but I love Southern California. And I want my grandchildren to be growing up here too. And to have that happen, I've got to deal with these issues. And right now, Southern California seems to be willing to work with me.
I'm Tom. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking earthquakes, Los Angeles, and the big one this hour with the seismologist, survivalist, really, who's thinking through how the city may survive when the big one comes. And it's a matter of when. Lucille Jones is with us from Pasadena, California, science advisor for seismic safety for the mayor of Los Angeles, talking up ways L.A. can prepare to minimize damage that could be massive. And we're hearing that. We'll hear from a reporter at the L.A. Times in just a moment about how that is being received in L.A. Lots of callers for you, Lucy. A.J. in La Mesa, California, south of L.A. A.J., thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. It seems to me that one of the ways that we could address both the chronic water shortage in the West, also the effects that agriculture is having on the soil in the Central and Imperial Valleys, and make energy at the same time is by putting stations offshore, lining the coast, and using a combination of wind and solar. That would be solar thermal as well as photovoltaic.
For what? Are you saying desalinization on a massive scale?
Yeah. Exactly, Tom, and you would have a great surplus of power that you could then use inland, but by doing this with seawater, it's essentially an inexhaustible supply. You could make the water chemically pure, so for agriculture, you would add just those trace elements necessary and begin to alleviate the salt problem.
AJ, we've got it. Our time is short. That's a very ambitious idea. Lucy Jones, is there a solution there? Massive-scale desalinization, so don't worry about the water tunnels anymore.
Well, that's the direction we've got to go. And that's one of the things that we're doing, is that earthquake resilience and long-term sustainability really are the same thing, because the failures that you see in a disaster happen at the places where your system is already weak. I mean, we said for the earthquake, the really big issues would be water, fire, and healthcare. Where does California have problems on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah. So prepare there and prepare for all. You mentioned New Orleans. Plenty of listeners there. Neyland's calling from New Orleans. Hi, Neyland. You're on the air with Lucy Jones.
Greetings. First of all, I love Lucy. Love everything.
We've heard that before. what do you think, Neyland?
Well, I'm sort of a giver of disasters because I've been in New York for 9/11. I lived in L.A. many times. I was there for Northridge, Whittier. Other ones I can't remember now.
Neyland, your line is really bad. Take us right to your point, sir, if you'd be kind enough.
Okay, my point is that I don't think people are naturally prepared, and I think they should come up with some simple things like cash, dash, and flash, to have cash on hand, hard sole shoes to get out, and then flash with everything you need on a flash stick, and then get out of the danger zones when it's time.
Neyland, I appreciate your call from New Orleans. How about that? Cash, flash, and dash, hard-soled shoes, everything backed up on a thumb drive or something, and get out.
All of those are things that we recommend people doing to be ready for the earthquake, or at least to, you know, have your shoes in your car, have backup power because your ATMs won't work, and have your information. Those are all good things, but we have seen a change in how people are responding to disasters, really only in the last 5 or 10 years. And I attribute it to globalization. You know, that the disaster in any one area doesn't happen that often. So it's easy to forget. Nobody in LA remembers what happened in 1857.
Yep.
But now when you can average it out over the whole world, a big disaster is happening somewhere. So
and we see
the Japanese
all.
Earthquake in 2011, mm-hmm. we watch it in detail and we believe it. So we're seeing a change in people's willingness to get ready.
I want to bring in Rosanna Shah. She's a reporter, earthquake safety reporter for the LA Times. Rosanna in Los Angeles, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Lucy Jones is making a lot of public appearances, talking up preparedness here, and there's a big price tag along with it. Do you sense that LA is being made ready to make a big, big investment in the kind of wise readiness that Lucy Jones is proposing? That the price tag must be enormous, Rosanna.
Yeah, I mean, as Lucy pointed out, there are a number of infrastructure issues that need to be looked at in L.A. We've been particularly looking at building safety, older office and apartment buildings that were built before engineers knew just what was strong enough to survive in an earthquake. And we've been looking at retrofitting, which is, you know, something that is challenging because most of these buildings are privately owned, and getting building owners and tenants to come together and think about how to pay for these really expensive fixes.
Is LA ready to do it, Rosanna, at the individual homeowner level, at the business owner level? community-wide when it comes to power lines and water pipes and tunnels and all the rest. Is L.A. close to ready to step up and pay the price tag for this?
Depends on how you define close. I mean, it's, I think, going to be it's a long-run process. I mean, if you look at San Francisco, they just launched a 30-year plan to look at all the older buildings in their city that need to be fixed. And that 30-year plan took about 10, 15 years to even get to the table to be passed by lawmakers. It's interesting. I mean, Lucy mentioned this earlier on the show. Everyone right now seems open and willing to come to the same table and talk about how to get these buildings safer. But we're talking about it right now, tenants, building owners, business owners. But there hasn't been really anything specific on the table yet that talks about who exactly is going to pay. And I think that's when things are going to get sticky. And I think that's what Lucy's, correct me if I'm wrong, here for.
Preparing the ground for. Lucy, what's the aggregate price tag for the preparedness that you would like to see implemented?
We don't have that yet. Ask me in October. That's what I'm in the midst of doing. But it's definitely in the many billions. And you look, she talked about the Bay Area. They have voted themselves several billion dollars of taxes over the last 5 or 10 years to get ready. And so we've got to see that LA is willing to do that as well. But what's at stake really is the future of the city, and then hopefully we can convince people that that really is what's at stake.
Let me ask you though: the challenges sound so great, the price tag sounds like it'd be so big. Can any city, LA included, afford full preparedness for such a massive challenge? Is it economically feasible? Maybe a dumb question.
No. No. I mean, and that's the problem. Don't think full preparedness. We can't prevent everything.
I don't mean
what
prevent.
What we're trying to do.
Yeah.
What we're trying to do is make the system resilient enough that it doesn't come apart. So we're focusing on the biggest bang for the buck, right? We're looking at the things that are the really big issue. Things like the water system is a core activity. Rosanna mentioned buildings, right? We have trillions of dollars of buildings in Southern California. The mandatory retrofit, we're looking at the ones that we know are killers. So we don't overstress our healthcare system, mm-hmm. in addition to, of course, not killing people. We aren't trying to prevent all damage to all buildings. We're trying to make sure that most people can stay in their houses.
Rosanna, how do you picture it if it came tomorrow? Within days, would we have millions streaming out of L.A., or do you think it'd be more manageable, Rosanna?
That's, that's a hard question. I think that there are many, many buildings across the city that were built from the turn of the century through the 70s that weren't built to what we would consider good code today. You know, a number of our reports looked at concrete buildings that were built with not enough rebar. If you think of even one 13-story concrete building, a lot of people in every single floor, that's a lot of people that could be trapped or killed if even one building collapsed. So in terms of numbers of people who are going to be homeless, who die, those are numbers that are pretty scary. But the city has already taken a number of steps in what we are expecting to be several seismic safety measures on the city level. There is another type of building that San Francisco is looking at right now, apartment buildings that have more than 5 units that are built on stilts over carports. And the city has embarked on a mission to find, I think, more than 5,000 of these buildings across the city and see if they can get retrofitted.
Huge.
15,000.
15,000. Huge city. Huge challenge, kind of hard even to fully picture, but Lucy Jones looking to make it real. Rosanna Shaw with the LA Times, earthquake safety reporter there. Rosanna, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Lucy Jones, good luck to you. The clock is ticking. We all know that. How long it takes, we don't know. We wish preparedness and the best of luck to Los Angeles. Thank you for joining us, Lucy.
Thank you very much for having me.
In a moment, we turn to San Francisco and its big battles over housing and development. This is On Point. Land development and housing is always a hot political issue in San Francisco. It's gotten especially heated lately with the passage of a new law to stop development on the San Francisco waterfront and two more bills fighting their way into a November ballot that to stymie the hopes of developers. Joining me now to explain is John Cote, City Hall reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. John, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
So what's on the line here? What's being fought over?
Really, what's being fought over is the character of San Francisco as a city. This is a city that's really struggling at this point to hold on to its middle class and not become a home for just the very rich and the poor.
So here's a city with a lot of waterfront, and that seems to be on the front line here. What's been proposed in terms of development? What's been proposed in terms of stopping development?
Well, there are a couple of things that are either have been recently passed or are working their way through the system. The waterfront in San Francisco is something that's cherished by many residents. San Francisco,
sure,
through its history, it's been a port city. And the waterfront is an area where you have a few sort of prime parcels in high density areas that would go for a pretty penny to develop, and then some other more industrial areas. And so, what voters in San Francisco recently decided was that any development along the waterfront, if it was going to be above the existing height limits, which were basically set in the mid-90s.
At what height?
Well, it varies, but the most of the heights are about 40 feet. They generally range from 40 to 80 feet, so you're talking about a four-story building to an eight-story building.
Mm-hmm.
But in some instances, it goes up to 105 feet.
Okay. So, but generally, what, voters want to be able to keep it at that height, 4 to 8 stories, 5 stories, something?
That's correct. That's what that's certainly what voters approved in June. Now, I should note that this was an extraordinarily low turnout election. It was on the order of in the 20% turnout. So,
and this would give voters the right to vote on any proposal higher than those old limits. Is that right, John?
That's correct.
So voters have generally been against it. So here comes your concern. If that waterfront can't be developed more densely, what does it mean for housing and for the economy, for the population of San Francisco?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. Certainly, the mayor here, who has made job creation and more recently has made the construction of housing a priority, says that if you have these kind of limitations, you are going to severely impact the ability of the city to build affordable housing. Affordable housing in San Francisco primarily comes from building market rate housing. Developers come in, do large developments or various market rate developments, and then they either have to put affordable housing into those developments, or they have to pay a fee to the city, and the city gets money, and then it will build affordable housing, elsewhere on its own. But the money for that essentially comes from market rate development, and so developers, the mayor, and some people, close to him, essentially say that, what this is doing is stymieing the creation of affordable housing, because every time a developer wants to do something that's, above 40 feet or above 80 feet, they're going to have to go to the voters. And that's an additional cost. That's uncertainty. No one knows once you go to the ballot, how San Francisco voters are going to react to your project.
Of course, it's a real dilemma. San Franciscans don't want to end up like New York, where you've got a wall of very high towers along some of their waterfront. It's a beautiful waterfront. San Franciscans want to be able to see it. But if you stick with that, and you've got a pretty high affordable housing requirement there, something like 30%, that's a lot of money or units. If you don't get that, what happens to the already very kind of exclusive demographic economic profile of the San Francisco resident, John?
Well, one could argue that what that's going to do is just make the city even more exclusive. Now, the proponents of Prop B, who are It's a bit of a diverse group, but it's mostly people on the sort of political left here in San Francisco who are concerned about, you know, developers, you know, who are politically and financially connected to the mayor, say that, look, you know, what we've proposed and what the voters have approved is not going to stop, you know, good housing projects from going forward. They're just saying simply, look, if you want an exception to the ongoing rules, you got to go to the voters to do it in this very specific area, which is the waterfront, which is something that you know, residents around the city cherish. They, you know, they go there on weekends to, you know,
sure,
stroll along the waterfront, and they say, look, it's not unreasonable to ask for voters to approve exceptions to projects that, you know, are above the existing height limits. And voters have done it before. They point to AT&T Park, for example, which is the, you know, the home of the San Francisco Giants, which is the jewel of the city. You know, it's, you know, arguably one of the best ballparks in Major League Baseball, and that needed a height exception. Voters approved it, and you know, it went forward. So they're saying that, you know, this is a lot of, you know, bluster about stymieing development because voters in San Francisco are sensible, and if the project makes sense and it's going to have enough affordable housing, voters will go for it.
You wonder at some point, John, if you get enough concentration of affluence in San Francisco, other cities, some going this way as well, if they simply start voting for that kind of elite population intentionally, if they say, no, that's what we want. We want a beautiful waterfront. You know, we don't want any hassles with poverty, and we're not going to let people in.
It's a really interesting notion, you know, and certainly this, excuse me, you know, certainly that cuts to the core of what San Francisco is struggling with right now. You have an increasingly rich population here. The gap between the haves and the have-nots in San Francisco is growing faster than in any other city in the country, and that's according to a recent Brookings Institute study. And so you have this real sort of existential argument going on in San Francisco right now about, you know, what do we want this city to be?
San Francisco, what it is and what it will be. John Cote is with the San Francisco Chronicle. John, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.